It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop, in for Ben Kiefer. The number of test positive cases of COVID-19 continues to climb in Iowa, and residents are encouraged to wash their hands and stay home. At the same time, healthcare workers are expressing concerns about a lack of masks and other personal protective equipment as the need for hospital and health support grows. We at Iowa Public Radio have been working hard to be your source for important news relating to COVID-19, but we know many of you still have questions about the virus that causes this disease and the possible impact of this pandemic on our healthcare infrastructure. So today on River to River, I'm joined by two experts here to take your questions about COVID-19 for the hour. Many of the questions I'm asking today come directly from listeners like you through an online COVID-19 question form we've added to our website, iowapublicradio.org. If you have a question in the future that you'd like to see answered through our reporting and programming, you can submit it there. Look for the link that says, "What questions do you have?" But right now, this hour, we have two experts ready to answer your questions, an emergency room doctor and an expert on infectious disease and personal protective equipment. Call us now at 866-780-9100. In a minute, Matthew Nunneman, Associate Professor of Occupational and Environmental Health in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa, will join the conversation. But first, joining me today remotely by phone is Dr. Hans Haus, Clinical Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Carver College of Medicine. He is also an emergency room physician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Haus, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And you're currently seeing patients in an emergency room setting in Iowa City. What is a day like for you right now? Has the landscape of the emergency room changed in recent days and weeks?
Yes, it has. We are seeing a lot of patients that have respiratory complaints or fevers. And every one that we see, we need to be aware and prepare for possible COVID infection, which means for us as providers, we need to protect ourselves. And so that means wearing protective gear, the personal protective equipment or PPE. So we're wearing that a lot. So now we go around our shifts, we will have a mask on our entire shift and a face shield on our entire shift. And that's certainly not what we're used to. And it's creating kind of a tense environment for us, but we're supportive of each other and we're all in the seat.
I could imagine. You may not be able to get into specifics on this, Dr. Haus, but can you give us a sense at all, kind of anecdotally, of how many people you might see on a shift who are exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19 or coming concerned about it?
I can't speak to specifics, but basically, it's at this point, it's a good percentage, maybe half of our patients that we at least have to at least consider it and look at it. Now we're looking for the COVID infections, but you know the business of the emergency department that never ends, and we're also taking care of the heart attacks and the car accidents and everything that we do on a routine basis.
Right, absolutely. So briefly, before we kind of get into some of the specifics, I really want to talk to you about your experience, especially with PPEs. But briefly, can you remind us what COVID-19 is and what some of the symptoms are that you're watching for with your patients?
So COVID-19 is the disease that is caused by the coronavirus. The SARS-CoV-2 is the technical name for that virus. And it typically causes a fever, dry cough and feeling like shortness of breath and feeling like you had the flu, but it's been known to at least start with some other symptoms, including like GI symptoms, and we just have learned that sometimes a loss of a sense of smell can be a sign of COVID infection. So there are some initially varied presentations, but pretty much a dry cough and shortness of breath.
And just about any person can theoretically get COVID-19, but some people are at greater risk for experiencing more significant symptoms or a more significant experience with the disease. Talk a little bit about some of those at-risk groups.
Yes, the most important risk factor or prognostic factor for COVID infection is age, no question. And children, good news, children are generally not affected by this virus. Their symptoms, if they develop, are relatively mild, and they have a high rate of asymptomatic infection. So they can still get the infection, but not necessarily show symptoms. Middle-aged people can get severe infections, but most will be okay, but it does, severe infections do occur. And for older people or people with underlying diseases such as heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, maybe on immunosuppressive medications, so something that depresses their immune system, people that are on medications for, say, rheumatoid arthritis or transplants or something like that, those patients and elderly are at high risk for this disease and are very have a good, good chance of progressing to a severe illness, needing hospitalization, and sometimes, unfortunately, needing an intensive care unit.
As I've mentioned, you can join this conversation 866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org for email. We have a question from a listener submitted online, Dr. House. The listener says, if I or someone in my family suspect we have the coronavirus, does Iowa have the testing capabilities available? When a patient comes to the ER and you suspect COVID-19, what are the criteria for getting them tested? Can you reflect on that a little bit, Dr. House?
Okay, first I want to make sure everybody knows, if you think you might have the infection, don't go to the ER. That's not the right thing to do. Actually, if you think you're sick and you feel like you can't breathe and you need to be hospitalized, then yes, then go to the ER. But if you're at home and you feel like you have kind of the flu or fever and you're worried about having COVID-19, don't come to the ER, but call your doctor, call the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics number, or go online through MyChart, and we can actually arrange a visit over the computer, over the phone, and do your visit from home and kind of screen you for symptoms. That's really, really important to do. And we're seeing a lot, we're doing a lot of those screening calls every day, and it's super important. So that's really important. But there will be, in the process of doing that screening, we will identify some patients that we will want to go ahead and test formally for COVID. I am so sorry. We cannot test everyone. I want to. I really want to test everyone. We just can't. We just physically don't have the equipment, the supplies, the materials enabled to do that. So we don't have widespread testing yet. Right now, we're just testing people that are highest risk for the disease with significant symptoms, or those who are known contact if somebody else is positive. So it's kind of a narrow group. We're trying to expand it as fast as we can. We just physically just don't have the materials yet to do it.
And to reiterate, if you feel that you might have symptoms, it's good to call your healthcare provider first before you head in for care in many cases, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I want to ask you about PPE, that's personal protective equipment, which you brought up a little bit earlier. A lack of adequate protective face masks and shields and other equipment, it's a significant concern for healthcare workers. Governor Reynolds said earlier this week that Iowa, like all other states, is concerned about having enough necessary personal protective equipment. Dr. House, can you talk a little bit about your concerns with this and your experience?
Yeah, it's kind of a scary time for myself and my colleagues and my other fellow doctors and fellow nurses in the emergency department, not just at Iowa, but really across the country. And I'm hearing all sorts of stories from all of my colleagues, and they're all facing the same problem, which is that we don't have enough of the equipment. We are used to using PPE, and we don't spread the disease between patients. So we normally would dispose of the equipment right away. We'd use it, we on one patient, we dispose of it, and then we get new equipment. That's the normal practice that we've followed for in medicine. However, because of the lack of PPE, we've made a decision, not just the hospital, but the CDC and all the hospitals have made a decision that we're going to go ahead and reuse our equipment. So we're going to use reusable face masks. We're going to try to preserve the masks, the respirator masks, as much as possible. And we're going to reuse some of this equipment between patients. Obviously, we're going to clean it. We're going to wipe it with germicidal cloth, with a material that will kill the virus. But we're definitely reusing equipment, and we're using equipment for longer than we normally would before. So, for example, when I worked my last shift, I wore a surgical mask, a paper mask, over my mouth to protect myself. And I wore the one mask my entire shift,
Wow.
plus a face shield over that.
How often would you usually change those?
Every patient, normally.
Wow. Okay. I want to bring Matthew Nunneman into the conversation now. Matthew's an associate professor of occupational and environmental health in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa, and he's on the line with us now. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here today. And you bring a really important perspective to this conversation because in addition to studying how viruses spread and patterns of infection from an environmental public health perspective, you also study PPEs. Again, that's personal protective equipment and the effectiveness of this equipment. Can you talk a little bit? You just heard Dr. House's concerns about his access to masks, his colleagues' access to masks. Tell us, why is this equipment so incredibly important?
Sure. So I think, some things to consider is, when you're in an environment where there's a hazard, so like in this particular case, we're concerned about, an aerosolized hazard like, of COVID-19, and you want to prevent the exposure to that virus. And so, the virus results in disease. And so by wearing personal protective equipment, you can prevent the virus necessarily from going into your mouth or your nose, or into your lungs, resulting in a healthcare worker that's infected.
As I mentioned, we're collecting dozens of questions from listeners across the state about COVID-19. We've been doing this for days, and we'll be taking more questions by phone today. So call in with your questions about COVID-19, 866-780-9100. Deb emailed us earlier this week with this question. Why is everyone talking about the N95 mask being in low supply? Aren't there other kinds of masks that will provide protection for healthcare providers? Matthew, can you respond to that?
Yeah, I can. So this is really important. So Dr. House mentioned a surgical mask that he wore during the entire shift. And he also mentioned a respirator mask. And, what we have is often these N95s, they're a filtering face piece respirator. And so they're designed to remove most of the airborne particles that we come into contact with. The specific definition is, I believe it removes up to 95% of 0.3 micron particles, which is the size that's among the most penetrating for that particular type of filter material. And so it does a really good job at protecting the wearer from airborne particles if it's fit correctly. And and if anyone's worn a mask before, they come in various sizes, and everyone has a different, people have different shapes to their face. And so it's really important that these masks fit correctly so that you can achieve the level of protection that you desire from particles. And on the flip side, if you're using a surgical mask, which, is like a paper-based material, there's very little fit around your face. Mm-hmm. And so that mask will move and that sort of thing, so the air can come in through the sides and not go through the mask material. And then the surgical mask material, isn't necessarily designed to prevent exposure to the wearer. It's designed to prevent exposure to other people that the wearer may come into contact with.
So, sure.
Like if the wearer of the surgical mask sneezes or coughs, there's a barrier there to kind of impact out a lot of the particles that would come out of someone's mouth. And from the healthcare standpoint, it's, folks wear it so that if there's a splashing event to kind of prevent large droplets from, entering the wearer's mouth or nose or that sort of thing. So yeah, they're really designed to do two different things. And their use really should be limited to people caring for people who have the disease right now, have COVID infection. Just wearing them in public is really not a good idea at this point.
Right. And speaking of that limited supply, we've seen grassroots efforts across the state and across the country to help compensate for the shortage in masks and other PPEs. People are sewing masks, 3D printing face shields. What are your thoughts, Matthew, on someone who, as someone who studies these materials, about these HOMEI efforts? Mm-hmm. Are they effective?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the I would largely say no. I mean, the N95s are, you know, meet certain design criteria, you know, and you know, we have colleagues in my department that, you know, have published research, you know, evaluating the performance of these masks and some of the traditional N95 masks and then some of the unconventional masks that are available commercially. And so, you know, that's, I mean, the work that I do is more related to aerosolizing virus, and it's less related to evaluating a mask performance against virus. Yeah, I mean, these masks go through, or these N95 respirators or commercially available respirators go through a really strict evaluation process for performance before they are approved for use by the agency that does the approval. It's the agency is a part of the CDC. It's called the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. And they have a laboratory that evaluates performance of personal protective equipment. Mm. So a lot of the materials or the masks that you can buy commercially, if they don't have the approval from NIOSH on the packaging or on the mask itself, you know, I would be skeptical about whether they protect you enough.
I'm joined today by Dr. Hans Haus, emergency room physician, and Matthew Nenneman, associate professor of occupational and environmental health in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. And we want to start taking some of your questions about COVID-19. We can't get into individual medical advice on air, but if you have a question that maybe you wish you could ask your own healthcare provider more generally about COVID-19, or maybe you have a question about how COVID-19's spread or how it doesn't spread, give us a call. 1-800-866-780-9100. Email to river2river@iowapublicradio.org. We have Alan on the line in Davenport. Alan, what's your question today?
Yes, I was wondering just how the infection occurs when somebody isn't showing symptoms. Is it the exhale virus? And also, how long does a period like that last? How long can somebody go where there are no symptoms and you're infectious?
Dr. Haus, do you want to take that one?
Yes, that's a good question. We know from other data that approximately 50% of all the cases, so half of all the cases, are asymptomatic. That's if you were to test everybody in the population. Obviously, we're not doing that at all. We're only testing the most symptomatic. If you do get infection, if you get exposed, you tend to develop the infection within about 5 to 7 days. The maximum period is 14 days. That's why we use the 14 days as the quarantine period. And then when you're actually sick, the disease itself can last for anywhere from 9 to 12 days. And that's kind of the typical course. So it does last a while. It lasts quite a bit longer than the usual flu. If someone is asymptomatic, they will not have symptoms at all, or they'll get very mild symptoms, like they'll notice a little cough or maybe it's some congestion or maybe some other just kind of overall just feeling kind of blah, like they have the flu. That is the majority of cases will have a mild illness, and about half of all cases don't really express much symptoms at all.
All right. We have another caller on the line, Dave in Northern Iowa. Dave, what's your question today?
Yeah. Hello.
Hi, Dave. You're on the air. What's your question today?
Well, my question is, if you get the virus and you recover from it, are you then immune to it? Do they know enough about it that you can't get it again, or is it something you can?
It's a question we've been getting a lot over email, too. Dr. Haus?
Yes. The short answer is, yes, you're immune, but we don't know for how long. Hmm. So there is definitely some short-term immunity that develops. The people do develop antibodies. Antibodies are what the body uses to fight viruses and remember viruses. There's evidence from the other coronavirus, SARS, that says that the immunity will last for a couple years, maybe 2 or 3 years, and then kind of wane, and then kind of fade away. We are getting case reports out of China where there's documented, it's rare, but it does happen. It's documented that people are getting recurrent infections. So at least showing the virus again, not necessarily getting sick again. So yes, there is immunity, but you can still have the virus in your system. We're going to learn a lot more about that over the next few months as we get the data from the United States infections.
All right, Dave, thanks for calling in. Ruth is in Winterset. Ruth, briefly, what's your question today?
I would like to know if it's safe for me as a healthy person to bake and share baked goods with others, especially if they have their immune systems that aren't very good.
All right. Do either of you have an answer to that question?
Yeah, I think it's fine. If you're healthy yourself, that's okay. It's one of the most important things that anyone can do to prevent transmission is cleaning of surfaces. So one of the things we've talked a lot about the masks and the N95s and aerosolized and all that sort of stuff, but that is one way this spreads. But really, the most important way this spreads, or a critical way that the virus spreads, is contaminated surfaces. So this virus will last for up to 24 hours on cardboard, up to 3 days on plastic, quite a bit less on metals. And so you have to clean the surface really carefully if you want to prevent it getting infected. So if you are making treats at home, that's fine, but just make sure that you're very good about hand washing, cleaning the surfaces you're using. And one thing that we're doing now that we're sharing treats, say like in the emergency room, we're wrapping those treats individually. So rather than leaving a big tray out of cookies for people to have, we're wrapping the cookies individually so people can take their own cookie. And I think that's probably a good trick to do.
Another question we've gotten kind of on that same vein. Maybe, Matthew, you can take a shot at this one. Do people need to be washing groceries they're bringing home, food they're bringing home? Briefly.
Sure. So as Dr. House mentioned, you know, the goal, if you want to protect yourself, is, you know, you need to eliminate your exposure to the virus. So if you're concerned that there's contamination on a surface, and you have to just clean that surface regularly. So if that means that when you get your groceries delivered, if you want to wipe down your groceries with a sanitizing solution or a wipe, I mean, do so.
Okay.
And Dr. House is right. I mean, the hand hygiene is so important, and we can't say it enough, to prevent exposure to this virus.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break here. We'll be back in a couple minutes to answer more of your COVID-19 questions. Dr. Hans House, Professor of Emergency Medicine, and Matthew Nenneman is with us. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Back in a minute. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop, in for Ben Kiefer. The spread of COVID-19 has changed the fabric of each of our lives. It's changed how we shop, how we work, how we socialize, and how we think about our health. We're working to bring you the news you need to know about COVID-19 on this program and throughout the day on Iowa Public Radio. But we know many of you still have questions about what the new coronavirus is, how it manifests, how it spreads, and how it's impacting our healthcare infrastructure. We want to answer as many of your questions as we can this hour. And joining me to do so is Matthew Nunneman, Associate Professor of Occupational and Environmental Health in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa, and Dr. Hans House, Professor of Emergency Medicine at Carver College of Medicine and Emergency Physician at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Let's head back to our phones. You can join the conversation, 866-780-9100. What do you wish you could ask your doctor about COVID-19? What do you want to know about how COVID-19 does or doesn't spread? Or maybe you have a question about personal protective equipment. Again, give us a call, 866-780-9100. We're going to head to Kyle in Parkersburg. Kyle, what's your question today?
My question is, like, for the average person, should they get it? How long they would expect to be, infected? And also after that, how long should they be expected to stay away from other people, I guess?
Dr. House?
So if you have a disease, if you're diagnosed with COVID, our recommendations are that you stay isolated until you've had the disease for, it's been 7 days since you started having symptoms, and you have had no fever for 3 days, for 72 hours. And then you should be able to go ahead and go back to work or be with your family again. If for patients who are being quarantined, who are suspected, and we're just watching if they develop, that's a total of 14-day isolation.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Kyle. We have Tom in Des Moines with a question. Tom, you're on the air. What's your question today?
Yes, my question is related to the advice that the WHO is giving around the world. The head of the WHO, Mr. Ghebreyesus, is saying testing is the solution to this thing. And I'm not hearing that resonating in the medical community, that when we have enough tests for everyone who needs them, and I think also that if the time between the test and the results gets narrowed down, then we'll be at a point where we can isolate where the disease is, and everyone won't have to stay at home. They can go to work if they're not in danger. But until we get to that point, we're going to have the disease run through our communities everywhere in the world.
All right.
And so I want to hear more from the medical community, from your doctor there, as to whether that is the right approach for us to have, that we need to get enough tests and reliable tests, tests that will happen in a short period of time, whether that's not the solution to this thing.
All right. So I'm actually going to take that to Matthew first. Matthew, you study the spread of disease. You study public health. What are your initial thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, my opinion is that, you know, the if we have the testing capability to test, you know, everyone, I think, you know, we would do that. But I think right now, this is my opinion, just with the resources that are available, the providers are maximizing the resources by testing people that they believe are the most at risk. And I think also, too, you know, is the treatment different based on if you know you're COVID positive or not? And I think, you know, Dr. House can speak to that more readily, but that's my opinion.
Dr. House, do you want to add to that?
Sure, a couple things. First of all, how the testing changes our management, especially for a hospitalized patient, is in terms of the use of the PPE. So if someone is COVID negative, then we can relax and we don't have to use as much of equipment and resources taking care of the patient. And that's an important step for us. Also knowing about what they can go back to work if it's an outpatient. But overall, the caller is exactly right. This is a critical problem for the United States, that we don't have extensive testing. It's better in some areas and not in others. We just don't have enough of them in Iowa to test everybody. And I really would like to. If you look at what South Korea has been able to achieve in terms of control of their epidemic, it relies on extensive testing. If the United States is going to get back to work, if we're going to get the economy going again, it's going to rely on extensive testing. That's the only way we're going to be able to do this. We can't maintain this social distancing forever. We're going to want to go back to having kids in school, and we need to be able to test everybody and isolate those who are sick and maintain that surveillance for a while going forward.
All right. We're taking your questions about COVID-19. Joining me today is Matthew Nuneman, Associate Professor of Occupational and Environmental Health in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa, and Dr. Hans House, Professor of Emergency Medicine at Carver College of Medicine and Emergency Physician at UIHC. On the line, we have Nicholas in Iowa City. Nicholas, what's your question today?
So I was wondering if at the hospitals it has been discussed to use ethylene oxide to sterilize mass quantities of PPE.
All right. Any thoughts on that, Dr. House?
I am so sorry. I'm actually not aware of how we're trying to reuse. Matt, do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I haven't heard about ethylene oxide. No, I have heard anecdotally just not just here in Iowa, but in other locations, they're exploring using ultraviolet light, a germicidal band to, you know, inactivate virus on surfaces. And I've heard that may include N95 respirators, but I think it's still pretty early on that. And I think, you know, the science on that is unclear. You know, in theory, UV light should inactivate virus on the surface, but there's not a lot of science on that when it comes to N95 respirators.
All right. We have a caller following up on a question they asked earlier about how the virus is spread by those who perhaps aren't coughing or sneezing. How can it be passed on if you aren't exhibiting those symptoms?
The virus exists in your secretions. So everybody has body fluids, whether they're sick or not. Obviously, if you have a cold, you have more mucus, you have runny nose, you're going to have more of the virus coming out your nose or saliva or cough. But this thing, this virus actually can attach to the GI tract as well as the respiratory tract. So it can pass in your vomit and in your stools, unfortunately. So again, that contaminated surface issue and not adequately washing your hands, that's how it is transmitted, even by people who don't know they have it.
All right. And Matthew, maybe you can jump in here. As far as sanitizing those surfaces, making sure we're keeping things clean, what do you recommend?
Sure. So what I recommend for everyone is that they go to Google and they type in CDC COVID and they go to the CDC's website and look at ways to protect yourself. It's really easy to find. And the CDC lays out some really clear guidelines on that. And you know, one recommendation they have is that, you can use a diluted bleach solution to sanitize surfaces. And I think the ratio they indicate on their website is 5 tablespoons of bleach per gallon of water and use it to wipe down surfaces and do that, you know, at least once a day for, you know, doorknobs, you know, countertops, you know, places that things that people touch.
All right.
And I think mobile devices, you know, that sort of thing. anyway, go to the CDC website. That's important.
All right. CDC website. We have Barbara in Des Moines with another question about services. Barbara, you're on the line. What's your question today?
Okay. Hi. Yes. I'm a truck driver, so I'm opening doors to go to the rest areas and whatnot. And my question is, how long does the virus stay on outside surfaces?
All right. Thoughts, Matthew?
Yeah, well, you know, Dr. House mentioned this earlier, but I think there's some variance there. But, you know, folks have suggested 24 hours. But, you know, the challenge is you don't know when the last person used that doorknob, and you don't know if that person was, COVID positive or negative. So I think, you know, using the precautionary approach, just keep washing your hands because, you don't know when you're going to touch a surface that's contaminated with virus.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Barbara. We're going to go to Karen in Marion. Karen, what's your comment today?
Hi. My question is in reference to personal protective equipment. And I appreciate that there's a lot of people out there who have a desire to help and they're making masks and other PPE items. So what's being done to test those items before they're put into practice? What's preventing those items from bringing disease into a system?
Sure. Thanks, Karen. And Matthew, you weighed in on this a little bit earlier, a little bit of concern about the quality of homemade PPEs. Dr. House, do you have any experience with this in your practice?
No, I would just reiterate what Matt said. I think that the cloth masks are really a nice gesture. They're not necessarily going to be something that we can really use on a routine basis in a hospital setting for exactly what the concerns that the caller have and what Matt expressed earlier. I think the face shields are a little bit different story because it's not something that it's just a physical barrier. And I'm excited to be able to use more of the face shields that I know that people are producing on a large scale now.
All right, Karen, thanks for calling in. We have Syria in Des Moines on the line. What's your question today?
My question is, why are there so many conflicting reports on the survival time on the variety of surfaces, and why is it taking months to find out how many days it lasts?
All right. Dr. House, any thoughts?
Sure. There was a very good study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier in March that it was was testing the duration of the virus on surfaces under experimental conditions. So this is not necessarily out in the real world, but in a lab. And that study showed that the virus can exist for a matter of hours on metal, especially copper. That was the safest. Cardboard, it lasted for about 24 hours before it became undetectable and it was not there anymore. But plastic was the longest, and it lasted about 3 days.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling in, Syria. We have Mary Ann in Bettendorf. Mary Ann, what's your question today?
Hi, thank you. I'd like to go to the restaurants and get takeout, but I can't obviously wipe down the food. So how long does it survive on food? Am I safe getting takeout food?
Yeah, recommendations on takeout. That's a big way that people are working to support local businesses right now. Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I guess just to reiterate with the caller, I really like takeout food as well. So I understand where you're coming from on this. And I think like we said earlier, probably, we have to rely on our, our restaurants and our preparers that if they become symptomatic or if they, don't feel well, that they stay home, they don't go to work. And so, and also that they're performing hand hygiene and that sort of thing when they're preparing our food for us to eat. And secondarily to that, the outside packaging, you might be able to wipe that down as well. But I think typically we really, and this is really, really important. So we need to communicate to our employers and to, everyone who's out there providing essential services right now that, if you don't feel well, you need to stay home so that you don't spread virus.
All right. Thanks, Mary Ann. We have a couple more minutes to take your questions today. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. We have a public health expert and an emergency physician here ready to take your questions, 866-780-9100. Pam is on the line in Iowa City. Pam, what's your question today?
Hi. Well, I didn't have a question, but I wanted to just comment anecdotally that I have a family member that has to go to dialysis 3 times a week, and they have to sit in this room with a lot of other people and for extended periods of time, and it's been really nerve-wracking for them. So my mom did some research online and found research about the survivability of different coronaviruses in heat exposure, and there was a lot of information relating to like SARS and MERS viruses that showed that they had that heat could destroy them at a fairly low temperature, like 140 degrees. So they actually have N95 masks that they take, and she bakes them at a higher temperature, like 250, for several hours to kill the viruses every day, so they can reuse the same PPE. And I was just wondering if that makes sense.
Okay. Thoughts on that from either of you?
Yeah, this is Matt. I'm not really aware of that literature, but I know one thing you have to be careful of when you're treating masks is that, there's electrostatic properties among some of the fibers that they use in those masks. And so, if the masks experience, exposure to chemicals or, UV light or heat, how does that disrupt that electrostatic component of the fibers in the mask? And so I don't know the answer to that for all these various treatments that are being suggested. So I'm sorry, I can't really help you there. But I understand your point.
Yeah, sure. We are taking a couple more callers today, but we also have listeners that have been writing to us from all over the state in the last several days and weeks. Question here, how are Iowa hospitals preparing for an influx of cases of coronavirus in the state? Are there plans to expand intensive care units as needed? And what do those plans look like? Dr. House, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the hospitals have been doing an excellent job of preparing for the coming wave of infections. One thing that we're doing is that we're reducing the number of elective surgeries, which is really frustrating for those patients who want to have those surgeries. But we're putting this off. We're putting this off until later on when this thing is better. Those that can wait for their procedures need to wait. And that's opening up a lot of capacity within the hospital. So we're building up our capacity in the hospital. We have some contingency plans for using ventilators in alternative spaces like, different parts of the hospital, even in operating rooms or different units to expand our ICU capabilities if necessary. Timeline for this, if the virus continues to grow at the current growth, we're going to see, maybe 1,000 cases by middle of next week, maybe 10,000 cases by the middle of February. And again, if it's current growth, by May 7th, the number of cases will exceed the population of Iowa. Now, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen because you and your callers, we're all doing this social distancing. We're all staying at home. We're all staying away from each other. And that's going to flatten the curve. And so that curve is not going to stay the same. And hopefully we won't need a lot of this increased capacity. It will get bad over the next couple of weeks, but I'm hoping that all the things we're doing now will have an effect and will flatten that curve.
All right. Another question. If I get COVID-19, what is the treatment process like? How are patients treated? Dr. House?
So basically, divide into two groups, those who are healthy enough to go home and those need to be in the hospital. There is no specific treatment for this disease. I know other treatments have been discussed in the media and in politics. But right now, there's no really viable antiviral medications for everybody. For people that go home, we're going to monitor your symptoms. We're going to check on you every day or two, call in, see how you're feeling, check on your respiratory status, that kind of thing. For those that are in the hospital, we're going to follow the lung exam. We're going to do ultrasounds or other procedures to measure the lung capacity and see if the thing's getting worse. And if necessary, provide additional oxygen. And in extreme cases, there are some experimental therapies that we can consider for patients or consider rolling in patients the most sick.
All right. Another practical question here. What can I do to keep my immune system strong and decrease the impact of the virus? Is that something that's even possible, Dr. House?
What I've been telling everybody, I think this is really important, is the one thing that you do have control over in terms of your immune system, stress. And stress will really depress your immune system. And it's a very stressful time for everyone right now. We're not working. Our kids are not in school. Things are not being normal. So it's an opportunity for a lot of stress for people. So exercise, eating well, going out for walks when it's safe to do so. So walk your dog, by keeping away from everyone else. Those are all things that's important to do. As the weather gets better in the next couple of weeks, hopefully we'll get outside and get into our gardens. I think that'll be a good stress relief for people. And that's probably the best thing that you can do for your immune system.
All right. Well, that is just about all the time we have today. Thank you to each of you who called in from across the state with your questions for our experts and for everyone who's been submitting questions online and through email. We invite you to please to continue to keep doing that. Share your questions with us as the IPR news team and the teams on River to River and Talk of Iowa continue to cover the impact of the new coronavirus. You can submit questions online by going to iowapublicradio.org and look for the link that says, "What questions do you have?" You can also email questions for this program specifically to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Dr. Hans House, Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Carver College of Medicine and Emergency Room Physician at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, has been with us for this hour. Dr. House, thank you so much for taking the time out of what I'm sure is an extremely busy schedule right now to fit us in. Thank you.
Thank you.
and Matthew Nunneman, Associate Professor of Occupational and Environmental Health in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa, has also been with us this hour. Thanks for taking the time today as well, Matthew.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer and live producer today is Catherine Perkins. Ben Kiefer will be back next week, but until then, I'm Caitlin Harrop. Have a great weekend, everyone.